www.cnemans.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Enron, once the king of Energy Alley, it's now being considered the granddaddy of corporate fraud and a modern-day morality tale about passing the buck. This last week, the nation has seen a series of shrugged shoulders between the I don't know of Arthur Anderson's Joe Berardino to the he didn't know of Kenneth Lay's wife and the we didn't know of Enron's board in a scathing report which blames the executives for widespread deceit. Now a few more key players are set to appear on the congressional stage, including Andrew Fastow, Enron's former CFO, and Jeffrey Skilling, the once president of the empire. Now, today's dramatics aside, the story will take weeks or months to unfold, but at some point, someone, something, has to give. Connection listeners, in the untangling of Enron, who should be held accountable for the company's crash, burn, and bankruptcy? Who should be leading the investigation? Congress, the Justice Department, or the media? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. With me today at a studio in Washington, D.C. is Joshua Micah Marshall. He's a freelance writer and senior correspondent for The American Prospect and editor of Talking Points Memo. And Philippine Glima, who is a partner at Bach, Robinson & Lewis in Washington, D.C. and was former senior independent counsel in the investigation of Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. And Josh, I'm going to begin with you because I'd like you to sort of put us in the picture today. It seems like a key moment to have both Skilling and Fastow appearing before the congressional committee, but is this just like chapter three in a 300-chapter story? What do you think?
I think it is. You know, this is the first time a number of these very high-profile figures in the case is the first time we're going to see them have to come before a committee and so forth. But Skilling may talk, but most of these people either are not going to have too much relevant to say, or if they do, they're not going to say it. They're going to plead the fifth. So I don't think we are going to find out tremendous new revelations today. But in terms of the theater of congressional investigations, of that, there'll be quite a bit.
And in large part, that's what the congressional investigations are about, isn't it? The theater?
Certainly what you see on TV, that's almost all of what it's about. On the other hand, there are staffers going through tons of documents in the background and subpoenaing files and so forth. So I don't think it's all theater. Certainly what you see, again, on your TV screen, a lot of that is grandstanding senators and congressmen beating up on this person or that person, who in many cases they deserve beating up on, but in that case it's theater, but it also gets information out for the public. Obviously, there are investigations, investigations going on at the Justice Department and so forth, but the public doesn't see that, and obviously there are, I think we have to assume there are going to be criminal cases here. But this is also a public issue, and so it's important that the public sees what was going on here, hears from the people. So there's a grandstanding element of it, but I don't think we should dismiss it entirely.
When you talk about the grandstanding, I'm reminded of the New York Democratic Congressman Gary Ackerman taking on Enron's former auditor, Arthur Anderson head Joe Berardino.
You're the captain of the ship. I mean, how do you let this happen, Captain?
Congressman, we are still getting facts. You want me to give you conclusions without all the facts?
How long have you been the auditors of this company, and how long have you been their consultants?
Our firm has been the auditor since, I think, the mid-'80s.
Since the mid-'80s, and now you're just getting the facts.
I want to bring Josephine Glima in on this. Joseph, you've been working as a lawyer in Washington, D.C., dealing with this type of thing for a considerable period of time. As we look at what's happening in the Enron investigation right now, I'm just wondering whether or not Congress isn't doing it backwards, trying to pull in all these really big fish before they've interviewed or questioned the people who may, in fact, know what was going on at the ground level.
Dick, please call me Phil.
I'm sorry. I miswrote that.
No problem. I think that it's fair to say that's an accurate statement, and there are probably specific reasons for it. I haven't conferred with any of the staff on the Hill, but there are competing interests being served. As Josh points out, Congress very much does want to appear to be responding. They do have a legitimate purpose to serve. And they want to show that the people at the top will be held responsible for the mistakes of their organizations. At the same time, any investigative process is best served by building a solid foundation first and not simply running to the top, especially because you don't even know what questions you should really be asking, what specific facts matter most in terms of approvals from the top down. Because in many of these situations, the construct doesn't come from the top. It comes from a mid-level or even lower. And so I think while it would be fascinating to see how these individuals respond, an investigation of this in toto, the overall effect of it, is going to be best served by getting those documents in, getting the people who were the foot soldiers and the people who were sort of operationally responsible for making things happen, have them point the investigators in the right direction and move up the pyramid, which is what typically happens in a Justice Department investigation.
And what does a lawyer tell a client when the two are considering pleading the Fifth? Because it always seems to me like invoking the Fifth is in part an admission of guilt.
It certainly is perceived that way by the public, and frankly, even some prosecutors will believe that there's often fire where there's some smoke. And so if the individual asserts the constitutional privilege against talking, then the investigator, the prosecutor, might believe that he's on to more than he may have initially suspected. That, however, is only going to be an atmospheric, a background effect of it. What's really happening in the legal process is a lawyer is telling his client, I may not know the whole facts as your lawyer. You may not know everything that other people are saying, true or false, everything that the documents say directly or implicitly. And for us to start wandering into this quicksand right now would be extremely dangerous for you. But your question really hinges largely on who the client is. And if your client is a public figure, either a public official or a high-profile individual like these corporate executives, taking the Fifth has a wide-ranging effect. It could have a future effect on investigations, and of course it could have a future effect on their livelihoods, on their ability to get back into the professional world when all the dust settles on this matter, however it shakes out.
But as you go from committee to subcommittee to Justice Department investigation, isn't there a point at which someone like Kenneth Lay or Jeffrey Skilling or Andrew Fasto is no longer able to plead the Fifth?
I would say that these individuals probably have a greater interest in pleading the Fifth now than they will later. The cat is out of the bag once you start talking. Talking to a congressional investigator could expose you, even without it being before a hearing committee, could expose you to a charge of a false statement, which is a federal felony. Making false testimony under oath, either before a congressional committee or a grand jury, is perjury, and that also is a felony. And, of course, simply laying down your position factually, committing yourself to a story, you know, the old line, that's my story and I'm sticking with it. Well, you better, because if you start contradicting yourself all over the place, you know that there are going to be facts and circumstances emerging from other investigative leads that are going to put you in the soup.
And Josh Marshall, you know the way that the Washington media sort of responds to this sort of thing. When someone pleads the Fifth at a congressional committee, doesn't that in sort of throw a little more meat towards the dogs?
No question. And I think certainly in the public forum, there is a pretty direct assumption that if someone's pleading the Fifth, the person has something to hide, whether that's fair or not. And I think, you know, in a lot of these high profile, obviously this is has a political scandal dimension to it, as an economic scandal dimension to it. There's obviously all sorts of legal implications. But one thing that's similar, I think, to this, to previous scandals, to impeachment a few years ago, and I imagine what's happening behind the scenes with these lawyers is you have that old problem that you have of balancing a client's legal interests versus their public image interests. And, you know, that I think is another, you know, another thing all these people are probably balancing right now. I mean, obviously, it looks very bad when someone comes up and pleads the Fifth. And obviously the committees, you know, go through this process of even though they know someone's pleading the Fifth, they want to, you know, kind of bring them up to humiliate them a bit. Maybe rightly so. The whole thing that happened with Ken Lay, where he said he was coming, that he's not coming. I mean, that was, you know, kind of a mess and there is a sense that I think that the media in town sort of thinks they're onto something, and there is a kind of a pack mentality. And when you start seeing people plead the fifth, you know, reporters, and I assume, you know, just the people on the Hill, they start thinking they're really onto something, and there is a not altogether pretty sense of, you know, a kind of a pack circling for these people.
There is also that fascination with the personalities, with Kenneth Lay and the stories about his life and past, and with Andrew Fasto and his involvement with the company. And Jeffrey Skilling was speaking some months back in a documentary that was done by Lowell Bergman.
We are doing the right thing. We are working to create open, competitive, fair markets. And in open, competitive, fair markets, prices are lower and customers get better service. We are the good guys. We are on the side of angels.
There was a real sense of hubris, of smugness back then, Josh, that I think is a part of what's causing the feeding frenzy on Enron right now. Are these three basically the characters at the center at this point?
I think no question. It's certainly true that depending on what we find out, this could expand into the board of directors. That's a possibility. There are other directions it could go in. But you touch on a really important point. I think one of the things giving this scandal fuel is that this company really did a big part of the corporate culture of this corporation was arrogance. And I don't think there's any getting around that. You know, if you go back to the ad campaigns that they had, you know, a year ago when they were all living in a very different world, they were based on this idea that Enron was this new visionary corporation that understood how to kind of take us to the frictionless market millennium. And they were breaking down the barriers of government regulation and all these old-fashioned fuddy-duddies who didn't understand how to do things as well as they do, or did. And, you know, this kind of hubris or this kind of arrogance is, in some sense, you know, something you always see with innovators. And sometimes there is there's even some reality behind it or justification for it. I think a lot of people didn't necessarily think there was, you know, that was the case here. And now when you just have, you know, the mighty have fallen so much that, you know, people, it's part of human nature to like to see the arrogant get brought low.
And Philip and Glima, part of the problem of the lawyers who have to represent those three.
Absolutely. You, as an attorney, you want to be shaping both the perceptions and the specific emergence of facts and how you counter them. But you have to decide pretty early on whether you're going to sit there and try and control spin or if you're going to worry about what the ultimate price might be for your client. And I would say that for most of these executives, controlling the spin is an impossible task at this point. They're just not going to be able to get ahead of the stories. You saw what the reaction was to Ken Lay's wife's appearance. And I think that they have to decide to protect their client's ultimate interests first.
Connection listeners, as Philip said, there is a lot of spin going on here, and a couple of appearances today before congressional committee. Skilling is up, Fastow is up, and the Enron story moves ahead. Who, in your view, should be held accountable? Is it the executives, the way the report from the board of directors seems to indicate? Is there more to the story that's not being talked about? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Buckeyes.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon, and it's going to be a news event when Enron is not in the headlines. In particular today, we're looking at the appearance before congressional subcommittees of the former president, Jeffrey Skilling, former chief financial officer, Andrew Fastow. But we know that there are dozens of committees and hundreds of reporters digging into all aspects of Enron's past and present. The Justice Department is busy at it. My guests today are Josh Marshall. He's a freelance writer and editor of Talking Points Memo. And Philip Nglima is a partner at Bach Robinson and Lewis in Washington, D.C. And Philip, One of the options that's being talked about is the possibility of taking all the committee work and all the justice work and instead focusing on a special prosecutor. That's something that you have some specific experience with in the past. Is that a real option in this case?
I would say, Dick, that it's a politically advantageous thing for people to be talking about. Folks who want to say, let's get this out of the hands of anyone who's got an interest, anyone who may have been involved. But just looking at the old framework, the independent counsel framework that we used to have, there's nothing that's emerged yet that would suggest that type of a trigger is needed. That was really based on a situation where the actual conduct of senior administration officials was implicated. Those people would have to be directly involved in something that could lead to criminal charges. And all that's really been talked about thus far is really the standard campaign finance operations of Washington representatives and of national fundraising campaigns for politicians. So far, I haven't heard anything which suggests that there would actually be a basis under the old statute to trigger the appointment of such an independent prosecutor.
But when you talk about the possibility of there being criminal charges, that also raises a question of immunity, which is something that the congressional committees have the option of granting anyone who would be appearing before them in exchange for information. Is that in your mind, a worrisome aspect of this case in that one of the senior executives might be granted immunity in order to tell the story and then basically removes himself from any further investigation or prosecution?
I'd be very much surprised if it happened at the level of the people we've heard going into the committee today and next week, but it certainly is the dread of the Justice Department. And there's a real historical experience in this matter. Oliver North, many people know that North was convicted. Not everyone remembers that his convictions were reversed by the Federal Appeals Court here in Washington because he had been granted immunity to testify before a Senate committee. And the effect of his immunized testimony on the evidence that was put before a judicial proceeding later was considered to be a taint. It was considered to be a spillover effect that could not be cured by the evidence that was put in by the Justice Department. So in short, a congressional grant of immunity can very much foul the waters for the Justice Department's proceedings later.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Iowa, and Rick is joining us. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I was just about a week ago, Arthur Levitz was talking about senators who were threatening to take his funding away if he didn't back off on reform of the accounting practices. And I'm just thinking that there's a you're saying who should be responsible, held responsible. And I think somebody needs to bring that subject back up and name names and put those senators' feet on the fire and say, you know, what was going on here and what were you doing? And now what do you have to say for yourselves about it?
Josh Marshall, it seems like that's already happening to an extent, isn't it?
It is, but one of the strange dynamics of this scandal is that at least at that level, at the level of, you know, political donations, so many people are touched by it. So many people got money from this corporation that in a certain sense, just having gotten a check from Enron doesn't really mean that much, just because that kind of taint, if it is a taint, is spread so far and wide. Obviously, a lot of those people are giving back the money. One of the things that Kyle referred to, and there was an article in the D.C. paper Roll Call about this about a week and a half ago, is that about a dozen senators, you know, at the point when Arthur Levitt, the former head of the SEC, was trying to put in place a regulation that would have said that if you are auditing a company, you can't also be consulting for a company, because this is just a rather straightforward conflict of interest. A lot of senators who, in most cases, were getting a lot of campaign money from either Anderson or other auditing companies were really going head-to-head with Levitt about this, and they denied it, but there seems to be pretty good reason to think. They were even threatening to support what are called riders that would have cut into the funding for what Levitt was trying to do. So they were really playing hardball, and what's clear now is they were getting supported by these companies, and they were doing the bidding of these companies, even to the point of threatening the funding of the SEC. And, you know, obviously, or hope, or one would think, if there's going to be a price to pay, it's a political price to pay. But one of the things this whole scandal is doing, it's kind of serving as almost an autopsy for this dead corporation, and people are looking much closer and seeing things that they really don't like. But this is the way it works in Washington, and this situation, what I just described with the senators and the SEC, this wouldn't have surprised anybody who was working on the Hill a year ago that this happened. This kind of stuff happens all the time, and this is why there are people who think that the whole campaign finance situation and et cetera, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is a problem. What's happened, though, now is that we're looking so close at Enron, and the legitimacy of this company and perhaps Anderson are so thrown into question that people are looking at the same things. Reporters are looking at the same acts that they were looking at before, but they're just looking at them in a very different light. And that's what I think may end up being transformative about this scandal in a way that goes far beyond whether any of these big executives may end up doing prison time. But it may spill over into these other possible reform agendas about campaign finance reform, about how we legislate on the Hill. So again, that I think is really one of the things that's most interesting to me about how this is developing, is that, again, we're going back, reporters, just the public, is going back and looking at certain aspects of the way that Washington works, looking at them much more suspiciously, much more closely than they have before.
Let me go back to Rick on that, because, Rick, it sounds from your question that you're more interested in the political accountability than you would be in any charges against any executives or the responsibility of the executives of Enron.
Well, I think that the dissection of what's going on with Enron is, you know, a great thing, and may lead to, you know, accounting reforms and whatever. But what I think is that, and we've seen this before, the senators, they get up there and they get on their microphones and they're, with self-righteous indignation, they blast these Enron guys who are, you know, maybe guilty and deserve every bit of it, but somehow they've just, you know,
You're not fooled by the self-righteousness of the senators, is what you're saying.
No, and I'm not aware of that newspaper article, but I don't see their names in the news. I mean, I see so-and-so took a few thousand dollars, this per senator got this much money, but the issue always on this campaign finance reform is a quid pro quo. So I think there ought to be a very much of a highlighting. Instead of seeing Ken Lay's name in the newspaper every day, we ought to see those who exercised the quid pro quo with this accounting reform thing.
Rick, thanks a lot for your call.
All right, thanks.
We're going to Hollis, New Hampshire. Barry's joining us now. Hi, Barry.
This is at one level, this reminds me, for those of us who remember the Watergate hearings, of something like the Nixon White House. I mean, it's nobody can seem to remember anything, and nobody was ever told about anything, and it seems to be, you know, sliding around from one officer to the next. But it's very clear to me that the board here really breached its fiduciary duty to the shareholders of Enron by not taking a hard-nosed look at what Fastow and Skilling and others were involved in. It's also clear that the officers of the company, in my mind, breached their fiduciary duty to the corporations as well, by essentially profiting in looting the company. And I hope that the Justice Department can find a way at the criminal level to bring a potential, possibly a RICO charge against this whole group of officers.
So, Barry, what you're looking for is the Justice Department investigation and the question of criminal charges against the people who were in charge at Enron.
Yes, that would certainly give a strong message in the corporate world that this sort of behavior really has profound consequences, and you just can't walk away from the consequences of your behavior. The other thing that I hope that comes out of this is that there be a true separation in the accounting profession between the consulting and the auditing functions. I mean, if Arthur Anderson is making $52 million a year off of the Enron account, and most of that is consulting fees, how much aren't we really saying that all they have is the courage of their retainers? And how can we really rely on the independent objectivity of an auditor in evaluating the financial statements of a company we're thinking of, one is thinking of investing in?
Let's bring Phil and Gleeman in on this, Phil, because that concentration that Barry's talking about, that zeroing in on what these executives may have done wrong. I mean, one part of it, which Barry mentioned at the very beginning, is the report that was done by the board for the company that the congressional people are using. I mean, is that a straight-ahead document? That itself could be flawed, no?
Well, absolutely. Everything that's being put out right now is only going to be as reliable as the fact-finding that they've been able to do so far. But the Powers report itself makes some very strong assertions with regard to the accountability of both management and the board. It is not completely forgiving to the board. I'm sure that an external review, and particularly a Justice Department review, will take an even more stern look at exactly what people were doing, what they informed themselves of, and what they may have even avoided knowing. Because for many of these potential offenses, you require a willfulness and a knowledge requirement that can be satisfied by someone deliberately turning his eyes away. And you used the analogy earlier of the monkeys covering their eyes, ears, and mouths. Well, in fact, the law does identify that kind of conduct as often being criminally culpable. It just will depend a great deal upon whether the facts were being concealed from them, whether the facts were apparent to them or were within what they should have been reviewing.
Barry, back to you.
Yeah, I know. I think that's where the investigation has to go. But you know what I hope to see come out of it is a very strong set of criminal charges here. If the facts support it, that really push the example of this sort of behavior out into the broader set of perceptions. So it becomes a kind of, you know, high water mark about what people in corporate, you know, America should not be doing.
I wonder if your expectations aren't a little high, Barry. I mean, at some point, can't the executives simply be tarred with the brush of being appallingly bad managers, but not necessarily crooks?
Well, I wonder. I don't know enough about the facts to draw the ultimate conclusion on that point, but it's clear that their business careers are probably over. But should Andrew Fastow walk away with $30 or $50 million in his pocket and simply, you know, net of his lawyer's fees? I mean, is that really a just result of the Enron collapse?
No, it's a good question. Yes, who's that, Josh?
That's Phil.
Phil, go ahead.
Dick, I think what Barry is complaining about is going to really center a great deal upon whether the securities laws specifically encompass this conduct. And you have to deal both with what the criminal statutes say, which are fairly broad. There are prohibitions on securities fraud and prohibitions on false filings, because as a regulated public company, this company was constantly filing with the SEC what its condition was. And then you also have basic insider trading prohibitions. And between those various levels of compliance requirements, as well as the specific obligations you have under standard auditing and accounting procedures, there is a highly regulated matrix that they have to deal with already. So, Barry, I do think that there are going to be some people who are going to have to answer to whether or not they were deliberately trying to navigate between the shoals of the shoals to them of regulation, or whether they were simply doing what the law unfortunately permitted them to do. And while the Justice Department has an awful lot of political clamoring right now for them to act, I think that we can anticipate they're not going to be pulling punches here. If the law allows them to go forward, allows them to make a case, they will be highly motivated to do that in this instance.
I think also another thing that's coming out of this is that one of the things I have been struck by in the last couple weeks is this phrase that's used, aggressive accounting, or overly aggressive accounting. And it's pretty clear that that in most cases, aggressive in this case is being used as a synonym for deceptive accounting, making a company's books look better than they actually are, and trying to yield all the benefits that one can in higher stock valuations and so on and so forth. Again, as I was saying before, I think what this is going to do is, I don't imagine that this way of using the term is a surprise to anybody in the accounting business, or probably anybody in the higher levels of corporations like Enron. But I think to members of the public, it does seem a little surprising. I mean, accounting, you know, we obviously in a corporation as complex with trading different commodities and so forth, that accounting is not like what we do when we balance our own checkbook. I think we all know that. But still, the point of accounting is to give – these are – again, as Phil was saying a moment ago, these are publicly traded companies. The point of this accounting is to give potential investors and actual shareholders a real understanding of where this company is at.
All right. I want to say thanks to Barry for your call and move along to Pete, who's joining us from Boston. Pete.
Yeah, how you doing? Love the show.
Thanks.
I offer you just a perspective, having come from that industry, and I think what
that's many, the accounting industry or the energy industry?
The accounting industry.
Right.
And I think what most people don't know is that, you know, basically an audit is a commodity these days, and the profitability of an audit has decreased over time. A way that many of the firms compensated for that was with special work or consulting. And so the two at this stage are inextricably linked, and many of the relationships produce scenarios where consulting fees are much greater than the audit fees.
So when we watch the other members of the Big Five say, well, we're now going to separate our consulting from our auditing, you don't think that can be done, Pete?
I don't think that it can, not effectively. The dollars are huge. It's, you know, with independence and everything else, I mean, I really struggled within the industry. I think it's important for the consulting to be the consulting and to be separate, and for accounting, I think for it to attain Arthur Levitt's higher moral ground, it can't be about making dollars.
Just Josh, which goes back to your point about we've got to look at the accountants as well as Enron.
Yeah, no, definitely. They're both. I mean, I think what's coming out here is precisely how closely tied they were. I mean, as in many cases, there are various situations in business or public life when two different parties should have somewhat adversarial interests, or at least an adversarial dimension. And accounting vis-a-vis a corporation it's auditing the books of is one of those cases.
It's the accountants, it's the executives, some people say it's the lawyers, some people say it's the politicians. How far, how wide should the investigation of the Enron debacle become? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Call us with your thoughts. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio, and we're watching the Enron scandal unfold. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guests this hour, Philip Nglima, who is a partner at Bach, Robinson & Lewis in Washington, D.C., and former senior independent counsel in the investigation of Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. Josh Marshall is also with us. He's a freelance writer and editor of Talking Points Memo. And as I said, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Newport News, Virginia, and Jimmy's joining us. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. My comment would be I feel very strongly that if we didn't have this conflict in Afghanistan and this war on terrorism and everybody rallying behind our current president, I think that there would be a lot more scrutiny of our current administration because of the close contacts with Karl Rove and Enron, Dick Cheney and his private dinners that he does not want to talk about, George Bush and his close relationship with Ken Lay, the fact that the current administration had such a hands-off policy to the energy crisis in California, and Enron was one of the largest money makers in that horrible situation. It just seems like there's a hands-off policy to the administration because it's just not a good time to appear to be not supportive of the president.
Are you hanging that on the journalists, Jimmy? Are you saying that no member of Congress wants to raise questions about the culpability?
I'm hanging it on the media, and also I'm hanging it on the political system because I think people just do not want to appear to be unsupportive right now. And, you know, as long as we can keep this terrorist crisis going on, it'll limit the scrutiny of the government. I mean, look how much time and money went into Whitewater investigations and Whitewater to me.
Let's talk about that connection, though, because Phil and Glima, you were saying a little bit earlier that it's kind of hard to draw that line. Jimmy's saying that he sees White House marks all over this.
Well, let's look at it on two levels. The first one is, are there those relationships and those connections and even contacts, which, at least on the last point, we won't know fully unless and until that Cheney information does come out. But the answer on those questions has to be generally yes. There are very high-level relationships, and frankly, we have to remember it's not impossible to be president and have friends who get into an awful lot of trouble. You remember Dick Nixon and Bebe Rebozo, before Nixon ever had Watergate. Jimmy Carter and Burt Lance, there are always going to be people who are trying to use power to their advantage. And, of course, our campaign finance system, as Josh alluded to earlier, does certainly promise people a level of access for what is simply a cash payment. On the other hand, we need to find a nexus between what that money did and what the government did.
Isn't there a nexus in those energy meetings last spring? And I'm speculating here, but at the very moment when Enron was at the beginning of its free fall, Enron executives were meeting with Cheney, helping formulate the energy policy of the White House. And while the Enron executives are saying, we're not talking, Cheney's saying, I'm not talking, and the whole thing doesn't look very good.
It certainly doesn't look good, but it would matter much more if someone were saying that the energy regulators had specifically given Enron a pass on one of the things that led to its collapse. And so far, I haven't heard anything of that sort. If there had been some suggestion that buying access to the SEC or to Federal Energy Regulating Commission or to one of the other entities that had supervision specifically over Enron's conduct that resulted in these gross overstatements of their balance sheet, if that were the case, I think that there would absolutely be justification for both a special prosecutor and for much more congressional scrutiny of the executive branch's actions here.
Okay, Phil, just one more question in reference to Jimmy's question, and that is, I mean, you've been in a position of taking on a member of an administration. How much a part of what you can do, what you can say, and the media attention you'll get is keyed to the politics of it rather than the actual facts of the case?
You mean you as the individual responding to the situation?
Well, let's say that you were the person trying to figure out at this point whether or not there were those links between Enron and the White House. And Jimmy's saying, you know, as long as the White House keeps everybody distracted with Afghanistan and the war on terror, that work's never going to get done. Do politics play that big a role?
Well, politics are important in your investigation. And one thing that we don't know right now is where the Justice Department has headed already and where they will go in the future. And part of that is because of a very proper grand jury secrecy rule that keeps under wraps the extent of what's being investigated and the results that they've found so far. We're being somewhat addicted to the instantaneous media news of congressional investigations because it's the nature of the beast. But in DOJ investigations, criminal investigations particularly, that just isn't the nature of it. And unless there are inappropriate leaks of information, which we've seen in many past investigations, we won't have the sort of finger on the pulse of where the Justice Department is headed.
I would say one other point to the caller. I think that this is a legitimate concern, and just say hypothetically that this all would have come up 3 months ago, 4 months ago. Obviously, it would have been even a very different situation. The sense of crisis was so intense, and I think it is true that the media is giving the administration a slightly wider berth than they would have absent all the events from September 11th, but not that much. And I suspect that, and I have to think that the White House is aware of this and perhaps not happy about it. That this is the rising story. The war on terrorism is, for better or worse, the declining story, and you know, God forbid some other terrible event were to take place, that would change overnight. But this is getting more and more attention. And I think the other point, referring to what Phil was just saying, as to criminal liability, that's altogether correct. Obviously, politically, there are any number of things that can be devastating to the administration, or perhaps we'll find out people in Congress, that could be devastating politically and things that will look and will have been very bad and very wrong to have done, but they won't have been criminal. The final point is that, and this is what I think is just giving so much fuel to the fire of this quickly expanding scandal, is that it's true. You have to look for, you know, if there is criminal wrongdoing, where's the nexus? Where's the decision that was made for a money quid pro quo, et cetera? Or where was just, you know, there too much influence or something like this? The situation here, though, is there are so many potential areas where things could have happened, where things are being suspected. You have the whole issue with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. You have the stuff with the Cheney Task Force. You have things coming out now possibly about employee benefits and the misuse of those. So this is just so wide, and precisely because Enron had its hands in so many different parts of the government, giving its money to so many different places, that you really just don't know where to start.
So is that why we have a dozen different committees looking into it? I mean, from looking at it from outside the Beltway, it's impossible to know where to look.
Well, I think that this is actually one of the reasons that it's legitimate that you have so many different hearings, because there are parts of this that are judicially that have a judicial dimension.
Have to do with pension, other parts, and have to do with energy, and have
right,
to do with
all these different things. So in some ways this is not if this were only about the Cheney Task Force and some meetings that took place and, say, did some completely hypothetically, right, and whether some money changed hands, then you would say, okay, here's what we need to find out. This is the jurisdiction that it's, the committee that has jurisdiction over it. But there's just so much here, and I think that this is one of the reasons why, and just watching this from Washington, one of the things you see is everybody, the mood that I've seen is just this sense of, like, people honestly not knowing quite where this is going.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Jimmy, thanks for your call. We're going to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Bill's joining us. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Well, I've been listening to this a little bit, and I find it fascinating that everybody is hanging the blame on Congress. They didn't do enough. Hanging blame on the president. His fingers were dirty. Hanging the blame on Enron. They were nasty people. When my opinion as an investor, and I invest every day and watch the stock market and dabble in the stock market and maybe more than dabble, the bottom line is the only person responsible for an investor losing his money is the person.
Bill, did you have any money invested in Enron?
I started to invest as it was dying and managed to make a tidy little sum on a couple of the bounces, yes.
But what about the people who put their money into Enron because they were being told by the auditors that the numbers were sound, when we find out now that they weren't?
Well, but, I mean, the other part is there needs to be a reality check here. You have a NASDAQ that is now, 40% of what it was 2 years ago. You have a Dow who's taken a considerable hit.
Okay, but the point, I really take the point that you're making, that it's caveat emptor here. You want to invest your money in the stock market, you take your chances, but shouldn't you have the right to believe that the people who are telling you what the foundation of the country, the company that you're investing in, aren't lying and cheating?
Sure, you have that right to believe it. But if you have a company that goes from nothing to $85 a share in 3 years, if it smells dirty, if it looks dirty, if it's too good to be true, my grandma always used to tell me, if something's too good to be true, it's probably something
too good to be true. Thanks for your call, Bill.
You bet.
I appreciate the reality check. 1-800-423-8255. And we'll go to Raleigh, North Carolina. And is it Addie calling in?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Addie.
Hi. I've been wondering about something. I'm wondering if the board doesn't expect to be held responsible for it. My reasoning behind this is Phil Graham's announcement September the 4th that he was not going to be running for office again.
With his wife as a member of the board.
Yes.
That's the connection that you're making.
Yes, I am.
And you're saying that the board is at this point not being held responsible, but they should be. That's
Well, I wonder if they're not expecting to be held responsible.
Josh, what do you think? Is that the way it's going to go?
Well, it's you know, a lot of it is just going to depend on the facts and what they really knew. I will say, you know, this town is rife with rumors about, you know, this person having this connection or that person having that connection. I will say it is in the context of the failure of this company that was a Texas company. It is hard to ignore, and people are not ignoring that close around the time that this company was going bankrupt, two very senior, very high-profile Texas politicians announced they were not running again for re-election, Phil Graham and Dick Armey. These are the kind of things that people are wondering about. In Graham's case, you know, he made that announcement, I believe, on September 4th. And from what we now know about the timeline of how all this was shaking out, August was the month when everything was breaking free within Enron. Jeff Skilling, I may have the date off slightly here. I believe he resigned as CEO on August 14th. This was also around the time that whistleblower letter that we've all seen came out. So
the board is watching all this all the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it is hard to figure that certainly Wendi Graham, the senator's wife, didn't have a very clear sense that things were spinning out of control. And when you know that, it's hard to not at least ask the question whether these problems may have played into the senator's decision to retire. That certainly doesn't mean that he had anything criminally wrong or anything wrong. Perhaps just knowing this was happening made him make that decision.
Phil, let me bring you in on this. I mean, you've seen this before with BCCI. It's not like this is a brand new event in Washington. In your view, do you think it's going to be some smart congressional subcommittee that's going to crack this open, some smart investigative journalist, or will it have to be the Department of Justice?
I think in the end, Dick, it's going to be the Department of Justice. I do think there might be some significant assists along the way from the congressional investigations, and even from something we haven't talked about here, which is the civil lawsuits, because in the process of obtaining initial restraining orders on the movement of assets mm-hmm. and in the process of trying to preempt further injury to pension funds, some courts might put into effect orders that result in disclosures that will be much more public than what the Justice Department is gathering. So there will at least be some public cracking of the matter through these civil and congressional investigations. But in the end, the Justice Department is really going to be carrying the ball the long distance.
Eddie, thank you for your call. And Joshua Michael Marshall and Philip Inglima, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you for having me.
Josh is a freelance writer, senior correspondent for the American Prospect, and editor of Talking Points Memo. Philip Inglima is a partner at Buck Robinson and Lewis in Washington, D.C. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.